The tercentenary of the former member for Hull deserves not only the celebration proposed by that favorite borough, but a little serious reflection upon his writing. That is an act of piety, which is very different from the resurrection of a deceased reputation. Marvel has stood high for some years. His best poems are not very many, and not only must be well known from the Golden Treasury and the Oxford Book of English Verse, but must also have been enjoyed by numerous readers. His grave needs neither rose, nor rue, nor laurel. There is no imaginary justice to be done. We may think about him, if there be need for thinking, for our own benefit, not his. To bring the poet back to life, the great, the perennial task of criticism, is in this case to squeeze the drops of the essence of two or three poems. Even confining ourselves to these, we may find some precious liquor unknown to the present age. Not to determine rank, but to isolate this quality is the critical labor. The fact that of all Marvel's verse, which is itself not a great quantity, the really valuable part consists of a very few poems, indicates that the unknown quality of which we speak is probably a literary rather than a personal quality, or more truly, that it is a quality of a civilization, of a traditional habit of life. A poet like Donne, or like Baudelaire, or Laforgue, may almost be considered the inventor of an attitude, a system of feeling or of morals. Donne is difficult to analyze. What appears at one time a curious personal point of view may at another time appear rather the precise concentration of a kind of feeling diffused in the air about him. Donne and his shroud, the shroud and his motive for wearing it are inseparable, but they are not the same thing. The 17th century sometimes seems for more than a moment to gather up and to digest into its art all the experience of the human mind which, from the same point of view, the later centuries seem to have been partly engaged in repudiating. But Donne would have been an individual at any time and place. Marvel's best verse is the product of European, that is to say, Latin culture. Out of that high style developed from Marlowe through Johnson, for Shakespeare does not lend himself to these genealogies, the 17th century separated two qualities, wit and magniloquence. Neither is as simple or as apprehensible as its name seems to imply, and the two are not in practice antithetical. Both are conscious and cultivated, and the mind which cultivates one may cultivate the other. The actual poetry of Marvel or Cooley, of Milton and of others, is a blend in varying proportions. And we must be on guard not to employ the terms with too wide a comprehension, for like the other fluid terms with which literary criticism deals, the meaning alters with the age, and for precision, we must rely to some degree upon the literacy and good taste of the reader. The wit of the Caroline poets is not the wit of Shakespeare, and it is not the wit of Dryden, the great master of contempt, or of Pope, the great master of hatred, or of Swift, the great master of disgust. What is meant is something which is a common quality to the songs in Comus and Cooley's Anacreontics and Marvel's Horatian Ode. It is more than a technical accomplishment or the vocabulary and syntax of an epoch. It is what we have designated tentatively as wit, a tough reasonableness beneath the slight lyric grace. You cannot find it in Shelley or Keats or Wordsworth. You cannot find more than an echo of it in Landor, still less in Tennyson or Browning, And among contemporaries, Mr. Yeats is an Irishman and Mr. Hardy is a modern Englishman. That is to say, Mr. Hardy is without it and Mr. Yeats is outside of the tradition altogether. On the other hand, as it certainly exists in La Fontaine, there is a large part of it in Gautier. And of the magniloquence, the deliberate exploitation of the possibilities of magnificence in language which Milton used and abused, there is also use and even abuse in the poetry of Baudelaire. Wit is not a quality that we are accustomed to associate with quote-unquote Puritan literature, with Milton or with Marvel. But if so, we are at fault partly in our conception of wit and partly in our generalizations about the Puritans. And if the wit of Dryden or of Pope is not the only kind of wit in the language, the rest is not merely a little merriment or a little levity or a little impropriety or a little epigram. And on the other hand, the sense in which a man like Marvel is a Puritan is restricted. The persons who opposed Charles I and the persons who supported the Commonwealth were not all of the flock of Rabbi Zeal of the Land Busy or of the United Grand Junction Ebenezer Temperance Association. Many of them were gentlemen of the time who merely believed with considerable show of reason that government by a parliament of gentlemen was better than a government by a steward. Though they were to that extent liberal practitioners, they could hardly foresee the tea meeting and the dissidents of dissent. Being men of education and culture, even of travel, some of them were exposed to that spirit of the age which was coming to be the French spirit of the age. This spirit, curiously enough, was quite opposed to the tendencies latent or the forces active in Puritanism. The contest does great damage to the poetry of Milton. Marvel, an active servant of the public but a lukewarm partisan and a poet on a smaller scale, is far less injured by it. His line on the statue of Charles II, "It is such a king as no chisel can mend," may be set off against his criticism of the Great Rebellion. Men ought and might have trusted the king. Marvel, therefore, more a man of the century than a Puritan, speaks more clearly and unequivocally with the voice of his literary age than does Milton. This voice speaks out uncommonly strong in The Coy Mistress. The theme is one of the great traditional commonplaces of European literature. It is the theme of "O Mistress Mine," of "Gather Ye Rosebuds," of "Go, Lovely Rose." It is in the savage austerity of Lucretius and the intense levity of Catullus. Where the wit of Marvel renews the theme is in the variety and order of the images. In the first of the three paragraphs, Marvel plays with a fancy which begins by pleasing and leads to astonishment. "Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow." We notice the high speed, the succession of concentrated images, each magnifying the original fancy. When this process has been carried to the end and summed up, the poem turns suddenly with that surprise which has been one of the most important means of poetic effect since Homer. "But at my back I always hear Time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity." A whole civilization resides in these lines. "Pallida mors aequa pulset pedi pauperum tabernas regumque turis." And not only Horace, but Catullus himself. nobis cum semel occidit brevis lux, nox est perpetua una dormienda. The verse of Marvel has not the grand reverberation of Catullus's Latin, but the image of Marvel is certainly more comprehensive and penetrates greater depths than Horace's. A modern poet, had he reached the height, would very likely have closed on this moral reflection. But the three strophes of Marvel's poem have something like a syllogistic relation to one another. After a close approach to the mood of dawn, then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. The conclusion. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball, and tear our pleasures with rough strife through the iron gates of life. It will hardly be denied that this poem contains wit, but it may not be evident that this wit forms the crescendo and diminuendo of a scale of great imaginative power. The wit is not only combined with, but fused into, the imagination. We can easily recognize a witty fancy in the successive images: my vegetable love, till the conversion of the Jews. But this fancy is not indulged, as it sometimes is by Cooley or Cleveland, for its own sake. It is structural decoration of a serious idea. In this it is superior to the fancy of L'Allegro, Il Penseroso, or the lighter and less successful poems of Keats. In fact, this alliance of levity and seriousness, by which the seriousness is intensified, is a characteristic of the sort of wit we are trying to identify. It is found in Le squelette était invisible au temps heureux de l'art païen of Gautier, and in the dandism of Baudelaire and Laforgue. It is in the poem of Catullus, which has been quoted, and in the variation by Ben Jonson. Cannot we deceive the eyes of a few poor household spies? 'Tis no sin love's fruits to steal, but that sweet sin to reveal, to be taken, to be seen, these have sins accounted been. It is in Propertius and Ovid. It is a quality of a sophisticated literature, a quality which expands in English literature just at the moment before the English mind altered. It is not a quality which we should expect Puritanism to encourage. When we come to Gray and Collins, the sophistication remains only in the language and has disappeared from the feeling. Gray and Collins were masters, but they had lost that hold on human values, that firm grasp of human experience, which is a formidable achievement of the Elizabethan and Jacobean poets. This wisdom, cynical perhaps, but untired, in Shakespeare a terrifying clairvoyance, leads toward, and is only completed by, the religious comprehension. It leads to the point of the Ainsi tout leur a craqué dans la main of Bouvard and Pécuchet. The difference between imagination and fancy, in view of this poetry of wit, is a very narrow one. Obviously, an image which is immediately and unintentionally ridiculous is merely a fancy. In the poem Upon Appleton House, Marvel falls in with one of these undesirable images, describing the attitude of the house toward its master. Yet thus the laden house does sweat, and scarce endures the master great. But where he comes, the swelling hall stirs, and the square grows spherical. Which, whatever its intention, is more absurd than it was intended to be. Marvel also falls into the even commoner error of images which are overdeveloped or distracting, which support nothing but their own misshapen bodies. And now the salmon fishers moist, their leathern boats begin to hoist, and like Antipodes in shoes, have shot their heads in their canoes. At this sort of image, a choice collection may be found in Johnson's Life of Cooley. But the images in The Coy Mistress are not only witty, but satisfy the elucidation of imagination given by Coleridge. Quote, "This power reveals itself in the balance or reconcilement of opposite or discordant qualities, of sameness with difference, the general with the concrete, the idea with the image, the individual with the representative, the sense of novelty and freshness with old and familiar objects, a more than usual state of emotion with more than usual order, judgment ever awake and steady self-possession, with enthusiasm and feeling profound or vehement." End of quote. Coleridge's statement applies also to the following verses, which are selected because of their similarity and because they illustrate the marked caesura which Marvel often introduces in a short line. "The tawny mowers enter next, who seem like Israelites to be walking on foot through a green sea. And now the meadows fresher dyed, whose grass, with moisture color dashed, seems as green silks but newly washed. He hangs in shades the orange bright, like golden lamps in a green night, annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shade. Had it lived long, it would have been lilies without, roses within." The whole poem, from which the last of these quotations is drawn, The Nymph and the Faun, is built upon a very slight foundation, and we can imagine what some of our modern practitioners of slight themes would have made of it. But we need not descend to an invidious contemporaneity to point the difference. Here are six lines from The Nymph and the Faun. "I have a garden of my own, but so with roses overgrown and lilies, that you would it guess to be a little wilderness, and all the springtime of the year it only loveth to be there." And here are five lines from The Nymph's Song to Hylas, in The Life and Death of Jason by William Morris. "I know a little garden close, set thick with lily and red rose, where I would wander if I might, from dewy dawn to dewy night, and have one with me wandering." So far the resemblance is more striking than the difference. Although we might just notice the vagueness of allusion in the last line to some indefinite person, form, or phantom, compared with the more explicit reference of emotion to objects which we should expect from Marvel. But in the latter part of the poem, Morris divaricates widely. "Yet tottering as I am and weak, still have I left a little breath to seek within the jaws of death an entrance to that happy place, to seek the unforgotten face once seen, once kissed, once reft from me, anigh the murmuring of the sea." Here the resemblance, if there is any, is to the latter part of The Coy Mistress. As for the difference, it could not be more pronounced. The effect of Morris's charming poem depends upon the mistiness of the feeling and the vagueness of its object, the effect of Marvel's upon its bright, hard precision. And this precision is not due to the fact that Marvel is concerned with cruder or simpler or more carnal emotions. The emotion of Morris is not more refined or more spiritual, it is merely more vague. If anyone doubts whether the more refined or spiritual emotion can be precise, he should study the treatment of the varieties of discarnate emotion in the Paradiso. A curious result of the comparison of Morris's poem with Marvel's is that the former, though it appears to be more serious, is found to be the slighter, and Marvel's Nymph and the Faun, appearing more slight, is the more serious. "So weeps the wounded balsam, so the holy frankincense doth flow, the brotherless Heliades melt in such amber tears as these. These verses have the suggestiveness of true poetry, and the verses of Morris, which are nothing if not an attempt to suggest, really suggest nothing. And we are inclined to infer that the suggestiveness is the aura around a bright, clear center, that you cannot have the aura alone. The daydreamy feeling of Morris is essentially a slight thing. Marvel takes a slight affair, the feeling of a girl for her pet, and gives it a connection with that inexhaustible and terrible nebula of emotion which surrounds all our exact and practical passions and mingles with them. Again, Marvel does this in a poem, which, because of its formal pastoral machinery, may appear a trifling object. Clorinda. Near this, the fountain's liquid bell tinkles within the concave shell. Damon. Might a soul bathe there and be clean, or slake its drought? Where we find that a metaphor has suddenly wrapped us to the image of spiritual purgation. There is here the element of surprise, as when Villon says, Nécessité fait jamais prendre et fait salir le loup des bois. The surprise which Poe considered of the highest importance, and also the restraint and quietness of tone which make the surprise possible. And in the verses of Marvel which have been quoted, there is the making the familiar strange and the strange familiar, which Coleridge attributed to good poetry. The effort to construct a dream world which alters English poetry so greatly in the 19th century, a dream world utterly different from the visionary realities of the Vita Nuova or of the poetry of Dante's contemporaries, is a problem of which various explanations may no doubt be found. In any case, the result makes a poet of the 19th century of the same size as Marvel a more trivial and less serious figure. Marvel is no greater personality than William Morris, but he had something much more solid behind him. He had the vast and penetrating influence of Ben Jonson. Jonson never wrote anything so pure as Marvel's Horatian Ode, but this ode has that same quality of wit which was diffused over the whole Elizabethan product and concentrated in the work of Jonson. And as was said before, this wit which pervades the poetry of Marvel is more Latin, more refined than anything that succeeded it. The great danger, as well as the great interest and excitement of English prose and verse compared with French, is that it permits and justifies an exaggeration of particular qualities to the exclusion of others. Dryden was great in wit, as Milton in magniloquence, but the former, by isolating this quality and making it by itself into great poetry, and the latter, by coming to dispense with it altogether, may perhaps have injured the language. In Dryden, wit becomes almost fun, and thereby loses some contact with reality, becomes pure fun, which French wit almost never is. The midwife placed her hand on his thick skull with this prophetic blessing, Be thou dull. A numerous host of dreaming saints succeed of the true old enthusiastic breed. This is audacious and splendid. It belongs to satire, besides which Marvel's satires are random babbling. But it is perhaps as exaggerated as Oft he seems to hide his face, but unexpectedly returns, and to his faithful champion hath in place bore witness gloriously when Skaza mourns, and all that band them to resist his uncontrollable intent. How oddly the sharp Dantesque phrase, when Skaza mourns, springs out from the brilliant but ridiculous contortions of Milton's sentence. Who from his private gardens, where he lived reserved and austere, as if his highest plot to plant the bergamot could by industrious valor climb to ruin the great work of time and cast the kingdoms old into another mold. The peat no shelter now shall find within his party-colored mind, but from this valor sad shrink underneath the plaid. There is here an equipoise, a balance and proportion of tones, which, while it cannot raise marvel to the level of Dryden or Milton, extorts an approval which these poets do not receive from us, and bestows a pleasure at least different in kind from any they can often give. It is what makes Marvel a classic, or classic in a sense in which Gray and Collins are not, for the latter, with all their accredited purity, are comparatively poor in shades of feeling to contrast and unite. We are baffled in the attempt to translate the quality indicated by the dim and antiquated term wit into the equally unsatisfactory nomenclature of our own time. Even Cooley is only able to define it by negatives. Comely in thousand shapes appears. Yonder we saw it plain, and here it is now, like spirits in a place we know not how. It has passed out of our critical coinage altogether, and no new term has been struck to replace it. The quality seldom exists and is never recognized. In a true piece of wit all things must be, yet all things there agree. As in the ark, joined without force or strife, all creatures dwelt, all creatures that had life. Or as the primitive forms of all, if we compare great things with small, which without discord or confusion lie in that strange mirror of the deity. So far, Cooley has spoken well. But if we are to attempt even no more than Cooley, we, placed in a retrospective attitude, must risk much more than anxious generalizations. With our eye still on Marvel, we can say that wit is not erudition. It is sometimes stifled by erudition, as in much of Milton. It is not cynicism, though it has a kind of toughness which may be confused with cynicism by the tender-minded. It is confused with erudition because it belongs to an educated mind, rich in generations of experience. And it is confused with cynicism because it implies a constant inspection and criticism of experience. It involves, probably, a recognition, implicit in the expression of every experience, of other kinds of experience which are possible, which we find as clearly in the greatest as in poets like Marvel. Such a general statement may seem to take us a long way from the nymph and the faun, or even from the Horatian ode, but it is perhaps justified by the desire to account for that precise taste of Marvel's which finds for him the proper degree of seriousness for every subject which he treats. His error of taste, when he trespasses, are not sins against this virtue. They are conceits, distended metaphors and similes, but they never consist in taking a subject too seriously or too lightly. This virtue of wit is not a peculiar quality of minor poets, or of the minor poets of one age or of one school. It is an intellectual quality, which perhaps only becomes noticeable by itself in the work of lesser poets. Furthermore, it is absent from the work of Wordsworth, Shelley, and Keats, on whose poetry 19th-century criticism has unconsciously been based. To the best of their poetry, wit is irrelevant. Art thou pale for weariness of climbing heaven and gazing on the earth, wandering companionless among the stars that have a different birth, and ever-changing like a joyless eye that finds no object worth its constancy? We should find it difficult to draw any useful comparison between these lines of Shelley and anything by Marvel. But later poets who would have been the better for Marvel's quality were without it. Even Browning seems oddly immature in some way beside Marvel. And nowadays we find occasionally good irony or satire which lack wit's internal equilibrium, because their voices are essentially protests against some outside sentimentality or stupidity. Or we find serious poets who are afraid of acquiring wit lest they lose intensity. The quality which Marvel had, this modest and certainly impersonal virtue, whether we call it wit or reason or even urbanity, we have patently failed to define. By whatever name we call it, and however we define that name, it is something precious and needed and apparently extinct. It is what should preserve the reputation of Marvel. C'était une belle âme comme on ne fait plus à Londres.